Our second reading today is from Plato's Symposium, that ancient Greek classic. Plato wrote this as a play, and he put the words into Aristophanes' mouth, but Aristophanes didn't really say them. Plato writes, "Humans have never understood the power of love, for if they had, they surely would have built noble temples and altars and offered solemn sacrifices. But this is not done, and most certainly ought to be done, since love is our best friend, our helper, and the healer of the ills which prevent us from being happy." To understand the power of love, we must understand that our original human nature was not like it is now, but different. Human beings each had two sets of arms and two sets of legs and two faces looking in opposite directions. There were three sexes then, one comprised of two men called the children of the sun, one made of two women called the children of the earth, and a third made of a man and a woman called the children of the moon. Due to the power and the might of these original humans, the gods began to fear that their reign might be threatened. They sought for a way to end the humans' insolence without destroying them. It was at this point that Zeus divided the humans in half. After the division, the two parts of each, desiring the other half, came together and throwing their arms around each other, entwined in mutual embraces, longing to grow into one again. So ancient is the desire of one another, which is implanted in us, reuniting our original nature, making one out of two, and healing the state of humankind. Each of us, when separated, having one side only, is but the indenture of a person, and we are always looking for the other half. And when one of us meets our other half, we are lost in an amazement of love and of friendship and intimacy and would not be out of the other's sight, even for a moment. We pass our whole lives together, desiring that we should be melted into one, to spend our lives as one person instead of two, and so that after our death, there will be one departed soul instead of two. This is the very expression of our ancient need. And the reason is that our human nature was originally one, and we were a whole, and the desire and pursuit of this whole is called love. Tomorrow, as you probably have heard, is Valentine's Day, a bright red burst of red romantic love beaming out of a dark winter night. And so today we are discussing love, because love for each other, for our neighbor and for the stranger, is what connects us to the web of all life. That's what love is for, to bind us in holy community. But as you may know, sometimes to get to love, you have to go through hate. So fasten your seatbelt. Our story begins in a world without enough love. When Claiborne Paul Ellis, or CP, heard on the radio that Martin Luther King Jr. had been killed, he threw a party. I warned you that we were going to start with hate. C.P. Ellis was working at the gas station that he owned in Durham, North Carolina, when he heard the broadcast, and he let out a whoop of joy and immediately began calling his fellow Klansmen together for a celebration. Well, that was April, of course, of 1968, and C.P. Ellis, like thousands of other men at the time, found a community in the hate group, the Ku Klux Klan. He even found power. Draped in his white hood and gown at midnight meetings, no one knew or cared that CP grew up beaten daily by an alcoholic father. No one knew or cared that CP was an eighth grade dropout who married at 17 and could barely provide for his three children. The Klan gave CP an outlet for his anger, cursing the only people that were more oppressed than him, poor black Southerners. In total submission to the Klan's terrible values, CP found the chance to be a leader, and eventually he rose to the head of his Durham group. Through propagating hate, CP found that he had power, even with local politicians, who would call him secretly to ask for favors from the Klan, helping to keep African Americans afraid and without power. Well, CP was getting pretty fond of this power and pretty used to it. It felt good to finally get some respect, to have town leaders buttering him up for favors. So when the director of the Durham Human Relations Commission invited him to help co-chair a series of workshops discussing school integration, well, it was hard to say no. CP was adamantly opposed to school integration. And although he was not eager to be on a team that would include African Americans, he was happy to be asked his opinion. Perhaps it gives us a little bit of a window into the South at this time to consider that Brown versus the Board of Education had passed 16 years earlier, declaring school segregation unconstitutional. And yet, the North Carolina schools were still divided, 16 years later. And perhaps we can better understand the angry heart of C.P. Ellis when we learn that just serving on a desegregation committee, even serving as a Klan representative, got him death threats from fellow white supremacists. Well, as you can imagine, the first meeting of the Integration Committee did not go well. The representative of the African American community was Ann Atwater, a woman with a hard scrabble background and upbringing almost identical to CP's, except with the added burden of being part of a hated minority in the racist South. The meeting began with the moderator asking how they could ease the racism in Durham schools. Well, CP jumped right up and said that the problem wasn't racism, it was having black children in school. Ann Atwater shot back that the problem wasn't black people, but stupid white people like CP Ellis. Ann wasn't one to mince words. The next meeting was held at a cafe, and CP refused to even sit at the same table as Ann, to even speak to her face, instead going through another person on the committee, because he didn't want to be seen sitting with or talking to a black person in public. Integration leaders were perturbed. Was it possible to have peaceful classrooms if the two chairs of the integration initiative could hardly stand to be in a room together? Well, finally, there was a crack in their icy relationship. Lingering after a workshop, somehow CP and Ann found themselves alone and talking about their children. It turned out that CP's son and Ann's daughter both went to the same high school, the very poorest and most racially tense high school in the district. Ann began thinking out loud about how hard it was to raise children who had nothing and felt inferior to their peers. How ashamed she was that she couldn't give them a better life. How frustrating it was to work all the time and still not be able to give them a home and clothes that they weren't embarrassed by. So let's picture this for a second. An emptying school auditorium in the South, in a city fraught with racial tension. In the dim light, a white supremacist, the head of the local Klan chapter, looks at an African-American woman whose efforts he has spent his entire adulthood thwarting. He looks in her eyes, and he feels empathy. Well, in that moment, CP began to cry. He cried because he had the same struggles as a parent. He cried for his children and for their future, which didn't seem to be very bright. And to his shock, he realized he was crying for Anne's children too. I read this story in a terrific book called Being Wrong by Catherine Schultz. And in it, she writes that CP said, "I began to see, here we are, two people from the far ends of the fence having identical problems, really, except her being black and me being white. Well, I began to love the girl, really." CP cried for his children and for Anne's children because he realized that he was wrong. Because he realized their fates were tied together and neither family had much hope for the future. Because the hatred and the fear that he had based his whole world on was wrong. Not only was it wrong, but it made Anne's life, this person he suddenly related to, it made her life even worse. As CP cried, he realized that his life had to change. He had to change. Soon, he began working for equal rights in the South, even though he lost his friends and his powerful position in the community. CP began a new life, but this time it was steeped in love for all of humanity. So what happens when we love? CP loved and his barriers broke down, down, down. His barriers broke down so that he could love, first a person and then a whole oppressed people. Because that is what love is for, to reconnect us. Does anyone remember the song "That's What Love Is For" from the 80s? It's an Amy Grant song. I thought it was really popular, and when I was talking to Nathan about it, he said he had no idea what I was talking about. Amy Grant sings that love breaks down our defenses and brings us back to our senses. Love broke down CP's defenses so he could see Anne, really see her, and understand her agony. Love cut through the barrier of race and allowed him to shrug off a lifetime of racist indoctrination. Love breaks down our defenses and brings us back into the web of all existence. Do you remember this phrase, the web of all existence? It is the seventh of our seven UU principles, respect for the interdependent web of which we are all a part. And it's love that brings us back into that web. It's love that holds us tightly bound to the rest of humanity. What about the love that beamed out of the darkness of CP's racial hate, melting until all that was left was his ability to see Anne as one more miraculous human being caught up in the web of life? Is that what love is for? Just a little while ago, Jeff read to us from 1 Corinthians 13. I bet you've heard this verse before. It's very popular at weddings. And so we generally think about it as being about romantic love. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am a gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and I can understand all the mysteries of the universe and I know everything, and if I have all faith, faith big enough to move mountains, but I don't have love, I'm nothing. If I give away everything I have and I deliver my body to be sacrificed, but I have don't have love, I don't have anything. Well, it does sound romantic. If a person has everything, even supernatural abilities, they still have nothing if they don't have love. To me, it sounds like a Hallmark card. Without you, baby, and our love, I am nothing. But let's think about this verse in context. The Apostle Paul, a long time ago, way back in the beginning of the movement that now we call Christianity, was writing a letter to the people in Corinth, the Corinthians. And they were trying to keep these teeny tiny fledgling churches alive in a time of incredible religious diversity. And Paul is saying to the people in this church, hey, it doesn't matter if you have a person who can speak in tongues. It doesn't matter if you have incredible faith or if you become a martyr. What matters is that you have love. And we aren't talking about romantic love. We're talking about all kinds of love. Love between friends and neighbors and love for the divine. Let's look at the second half of the reading. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will fade away. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So what Paul is saying to these church folk is that love never ends. Now everything else, time is going to destroy. Words, writings, good deeds, all these things will be destroyed by time. And everything we know is incomplete or even incorrect. Our knowledge is like looking in a foggy mirror. Think of your bathroom mirror after you get out of the shower. You can see maybe the outline of your chin, maybe the side of your face, but you can't see freckles on your nose, and you can't see the creases in your winter dry lips. We might be able to see some of the outline, but we are missing most of the picture. And Paul is saying, folks, don't sweat the small stuff. What matters is love. Because if we get this right, if we spread love to all people, we will begin living in heaven right here on earth. And compassion will thrive between every person. We will live in an earthly paradise. Right now, we can only see partially, like in a foggy mirror. But the one thing that we know is that we have to love each other, and we have to care for each other. And our love for each other, well, it's the only thing that will endure all challenges. Somehow, C.P. Ellis got this. He had power and prestige, but until he had love, he had nothing. Until he began to work for equal rights, he had nothing. When he abandoned the Klan, C.P. lost his extended family. He lost all his friends. He lost nearly everything. But he gained love, and C.P. Ellis died a happy man. C.P. loved, and his love made him able to endure all the challenges that working for justice brought into his life. Our Universalist forebears deeply believed this. They deeply believed what mattered was loving and caring for all humankind. C.R. Skinner, the most influential Universalist of the 20th century, said that we turn away from the old religion which divided people into the saved and the lost, and we believe in the solidarity of the human race. We are all children of God, and so we are all one. All souls have a spark of the divine, and eventually those souls will reach a sacred harmony with God. The Universalists saw what love was for. It was to fuel our challenges to injustice. It was to remind us that if we are all children of the divine, well, we're all siblings with a deep, sacred duty to care for each other. Universalists like Skinner understood that we are all part of one web, and that as such, our fate was the fate of the rest of humanity. Hate hurts all of humanity. Love heals us and brings us back into sacred relationship with one another. Love is for tearing down superficial boundaries that the biblical Paul tells us don't matter, so we can unite without apprehension. CP loved and his fear melted away, and he came into sacred relationship with Anne, a sacred relationship that allowed them to work together to integrate Durham's schools. This interconnectedness is what Plato was referring to in the second reading as well. Plato believed that from the beginning of time, humans were one with the universe, single drops of water in an ocean of eternity. We were whole only when we were linked together. Plato said somewhere deep, deep inside of us, in a subconscious closet somewhere, we remembered the splendidness of that time, the time before Zeus splintered us off into individuals, the time when we were all one. That wholeness is what we are trying to achieve when we love. That's what love is for, to put us back into the web of all existence and to reconnect us with the truth, that's truth with a capital T, that we are all one, one web, one being. The Greeks and the early Christians knew it. The Universalists knew it. We were one, and someday, Spirit help us, to one we will return, but only if we love. As Paul reminded us, even if you have faith that will move mountains, it is worthless without love. It is love for one another that will get us there, love for the stranger and for the friend. And so, my spiritual companions, I challenge all of us to celebrate Valentine's Day by filling our hearts with love. Love for those around us in the pews, and love for people we will never meet. This Valentine's Day, let us pledge that love shall be our touchstone, our standard in making decisions, the guiding principle to guide us through our interconnected lives. How will your life be different if you base your decisions on making the most loving choice? How can you live in love, embracing the web of all life? Please rise as you're willing and able. And Laura, what's the page number on that? Thank you. Join us in singing my very favorite hymn, number 131, Love Will Guide Us.
Oh, now please join me in saying our call to ministry. We go forth into the world in peace to act with works of love, to affirm each person's dignity, and to cherish the living earth.
Let us go forth into our weeks and into the world, letting love guide us, trusting that love will guide us through the dark night. The choir will give us our final benediction.